Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of a Shabbat teaching by Rabbi Cantor Hilary Chorney.
Some of you know that I'm working on a book on ritual. So ritual is something that I study and I teach in depth. And I, in particular, I'm interested in the latest ritual renaissance of the 21st century. There are those who studied the ritual renaissance of the 20th century. In particular, there's this book from 2007, Dr. Vanessa Oakes. She wrote a really beautiful book called Inventing Jewish Ritual. It won the National Jewish Book Award in 2007. And it speaks to the last quarter century in the 20th century from an anthropological and a sociological perspective about the ways that people took ritual, elevated it, adapted it, invented new ritual, all of it from a place of deep authenticity. And we're going to circle back around today in our conversation to her definition of authentication in the context of Jewish ritual. Her studies take a look at a time in our history that was marked by publications like the Jewish Catalog. And one of the things I like to point out about the Jewish Catalog, which if you're not familiar with that, it was deeply intertwined with the Chavura movement. There was a movement of adults in the mostly 60s and 70s in the United States who were in a place of inventiveness around elevating Jewish ritual, particularly in the home and in one's personal life, which is different than private, personal ritual and personal Jewish experiences. And the catalog itself was a publication that represented many of those rituals. The catalog gave birth to an enormous amount of the rituals that today, in 2024, we look at and name as normative or even quote unquote traditional. One of the best examples of that is the Jewish baby naming for a little girl. Before the Jewish catalog era, before 1972, when a family came to the Jewish catalog and published this ceremony upon the birth of a baby girl, the most that would have been experienced in most communities, with a few rare exceptions of Jewish communities around the world that had their own different customs. Typically speaking, the most that you would have heard ritually in the Jewish community about a Jewish girl and her new name and her new being in the community would have been an aliyah for her father in the community on the next day of Torah when he could safely get to a community and take an aliyah in honor of his new baby daughter. And in the Misha Berach, the blessing following the aliyah, the little girl would be named. In 1972, a family said, what if we did something different? What if we did the same thing as the bris, but of course no circumcision? Instead of Brit Milah, we name the baby girl and we do it in a ceremony. And suddenly and almost immediately, it was picked up as a popular custom, and it is one of the most pervasive, semi-traditional rituals that I would say we have to this day. Interestingly, even more pervasive than the ritual of Bat Mitzvah, which is 100 years old. Because the notion of naming the baby girl on the eighth day transcends even more of the less gender egalitarian communities than the notion of Bat Mitzvah. So since 1972, we have this tradition, so to speak, which is really, it's not so much a tradition because it's so new, it hasn't been passed down so many generations, it's a new-ish ritual. I give you all of this context, and I could give so much more, but I'm going to hold back from it, because what I want to talk about and study with you today is an emergent ritual. I come many times, I've come at the High Holy Days, I've come on Shabbat morning and spoken to the community about how one can find new emergent Jewish ritual in the community. It is most interesting to me when we can spot it in the wild as it's happening, take a snapshot of it, understand what's happening, see who the authority figures are behind that emergent ritual, understand what their impetus was for creating the ritual in that moment, see what it means to incorporate that in the Seder. I'll offer one last little preamble to this, which is that to this day, the daughter of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, Susanna Heschel, struggles to get people to a place of clarity on the adaptation that she took on in her own home Seder to represent one thing, which immediately became something completely different. His daughter, Susanna Heschel, introduced an orange on the Seder plate in the 1980s in solidarity with queer people everywhere, with gay men and gay women. That's what it was introduced to represent. But the story evolved immediately. Many people think it represents it, an orange of belonging on the Seder plate like a woman belonging on the Seder plate. That's a completely false narrative and story. That is not the origin of that story. But what's amazing about that is that this is a less than 50-year-old ritual introduced into American Jewish standards. And to this day, I still see her clarifying on Facebook and the Jewish news circles, trying to help people understand what the origin story was. That's not my rebuke of the Jewish community backhandedly to say, already, see, we don't understand ritual. I'm using that as an example to say the minute that a ritual is biyadenu, it's in our hands, it becomes what it becomes and it means what it means to the people who do it and practice it. When I teach ritual, I teach that it's like a recipe book. If Alan or Marshall want to go and bake an apple pie this weekend, which is a terrible idea because it's almost Pesach, or maybe it's a wonderful idea to go and use up the rest of your chametz. So you want to go home and you want to bake yourself an apple pie. You might go and you'll look up recipes for 1, 2, 3 different apple pies. You'll find one by a cook who you really trust, a baker you really trust, maybe a New York Times Magazine recipe. And then you'll look at all those recipes, look at the skills that you possess personally. Can I make my own crust? Maybe I'm not really capable of making my own crust. Maybe I have to start from an existing crust, even if the recipe doesn't say so. Look at the apples you have and what's in season. Look at what you're interested in tasting, because maybe you don't love cloves and there are cloves in the recipe and you're going to leave the cloves out because that's not what you like in your apple pie. But it's still based on the recipes that you started with. What we're going to look at today is a recipe. It's a recipe for a ritual. And the notion here isn't necessarily that you take it whole cloth, introduce it into your Seder, though you could. I know some people who look at recipes out of their favorite cookbooks and follow them exactly to the letter. But most people don't. Most people take the recipes that they see and they immediately, and not audaciously, but rather with a lot of respect to the recipe itself, adapt it for what they are capable of doing, for the things that they have on hand, and for the taste that they have for that moment. That is the same story when it comes to ritual, and we're going to look at one ritual that is emerging this year. This is an article that was published in several Jewish sources, starting in the JTA, which is like our Associated Press of the Jewish people. It's a, what do you call it, a newswire? Like it's a publication that goes out to other Jewish publications by Rabbi Eli Confer. Is anybody familiar with Eli Confer's teaching? So who is Eli Confer? What does he do? You know him? A male rabbi named Eli Confer.
Hadar.
He's Hadar, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So it's the Hadar rabbi. He is in charge of Yeshivat Hadar. Hadar has many different branches. It's a synagogue in New York. It's also an educational institution. It's an educational institution. It works towards the education of older teens, young adults, and adults. And Rabbi Eli Confer is their lead rabbi. And he published the following article about a ritual. He did not publish it with the full text of the sources. I brought the full text of his sources here, many of his sources today, so that we could look at them together. But not only are we going to pick them apart from the sources, we are going to spend a little bit of time using the science, so to speak, of dissecting ritual to understand the efficaciousness or the potential efficacy of this ritual at a Seder table, and to also try to understand what he might be writing about and the discomfort and comfort that seem to carry in this article. So he writes the following. I'm going to break it down many times. I'll start reading, but then we're going to turn back and forth between sources. How might we celebrate Passover differently this year? With so many Israelis brutally murdered on October 7th, so many soldiers killed or wounded in battle, so many people, Palestinians and aid workers, dead or suffering in Gaza, we cannot simply celebrate as we did last year. As a community, We need to encourage ritual innovations or special readings to address all these tragic realities. I have a question and a thought. The question is this more true for Passover 5784, the Passover we're about to start, than it was for last year or the year before? Raise your hand if you think that it's more true this year than it might have been, let's say, last year. As a community, we need to encourage ritual innovations or special readings to address all these tragic realities, okay? Now, you're welcome to abstain as well. Raise your hand if you think that it is just about as true as any other year that we need to introduce other readings. Okay? Tybalt's raising her hand for this as well. You've got company online. And there's probably some truth in between as well. Marshall, you're somewhere in between there. It is true, it's not true. Can I say we should never approach the Seder mechanically? Is that fair? Right. So there have been times of tremendous tragedy, difficulty, trauma, narrow spaceness in the Jewish people through which we've had to celebrate Passover. This would at least be true, you might say, at any time when we're experiencing trauma, just experienced trauma in that narrow space. And you might also say, as Marshall was saying, that you shouldn't anyway approach the Passover Seder with a sense of mechanical ritual. We're not going through motions. We're never going through motions. I'm going to offer four things that I wish I had printed on this paper in retrospect, but I'm going to offer you these four ideas. They come out of the Stanford Design School, specifically their ritual lab. At the Stanford Design School, Drs. Kurzat Ozenk and Margaret Hagen say that you need four principles for a ritual to be a ritual. Number one, it needs a je ne sais quoi factor. You cannot quite put your finger on it, but this is something a little different. That is the most symbolic piece and the hardest to scientifically put into a box. But as a ritual can't just be a ritual produced mechanically. Even the production can't be mechanical. It has to be that when you suggest the ritual that people will then follow, that the suggestion itself followed by the implementation of it happens with a certain something that's unlike anything else that's happening that night, unlike anything else that happens any other night. Number two, the ritual has to be done with intentionality. Neither of these authors are Jewish, but for them, intentionality is actually at the fore. It's one of the core four principles. You cannot absentmindedly do a ritual. A ritual takes intentional doing. And of course, in Judaism, this is a core principle as well. We must actually fulfill our obligations in many cases, bechavana, intentionally. Number three, it cannot merely be practical. Whatever Rabbi Confer is about to suggest, if it's going to be a new ritual, to be a technical new ritual, it cannot simply be that it's a practical matter. Of course, almost everything at the Passover Seder, can you think of anything that is purely practical anyway at a Passover Seder? Great. So the disruption of the work that it takes to prepare for a Seder in and of itself isn't practical. I like that notion that it is not practical and therefore it can't possibly be practical at its core. I would also say that the assumed symbology behind everything that we do at the Seder takes it out of the realm of the merely practical. When I'm talking about non-Passover rituals, one of the things that I like to go back to historically is that we lit candles on Friday evening once upon a time. Why? Why is the initial factor of lighting candles, either with oil or wax? Why do we light candles on Friday night? You didn't have light, and you needed to have light. You were forbidden to light the lights during a Shabbat. You need light in the darkness of your home on a Friday evening, and therefore, you need to light lights. Today, I can light lights by turning on a light switch. Does that count for my blessing? Lahadlik ner shel Shabbat? Great. In Judaism, the ritual of lighting the candles survived past its practicality. It turned into a ritual because of its practicality. I want to give you another example, hand washing. When we wash our hands before we eat bread, are we today washing our hands for the sake of health and safety when we do Netilat Yadayim? No. Is it okay if by happenstance it's also practical to wash our hands? Is it okay if by happenstance the lights of Shabbat also light up the room that we're in?
Of course.
That doesn't erase what makes a ritual impractical, so to speak. The point is it must go beyond the practical in addition to being the practical. And finally, in addition to the je ne sais quoi factor, a sense of intentionality, also going beyond the practical, it must evolve over time. Rituals do not stagnate. That is the ritual side definition of non-mechanically going through the Seder. The ritual itself, once introduced, must evolve, or more easily seen, I think, is if you deconstruct an existing ritual. You look at a ritual that exists. Ellie Confer here is about to invent a ritual. But if you look at an existing ritual and you deconstruct it, you will see it has changed. It must have. Rituals never, ever completely stagnate. Even if you have been lighting candles exactly the same way, at the same with the same blessing every single week for Shabbat, I bet you've gotten a new pair of candlesticks. I bet you light in a different place in your home today than whatever home you were living in even 15 years ago. I bet even if you live in the same home as you did 15 years ago, you have changed the type of candles that you're using at some point for practicality, or because someone gave you a box of candles from Svat, and so you're using those. I bet the way that you light them has changed. I bet your kids, if you have kids, at some point, and maybe it's still the case for some of us, are too young to light them, but then they got old enough and they could light them themselves because it was safe. That is all evolution of the ritual itself. Every element shifts. That is different than the examples of tradition, of quote-unquote ritual tradition that get passed down, those that are written into the letter of the law, for example, in terms of, I'm trying to think of the broader category is, but if you go to a palace in England and you watch the honor guard in their routine, in their ritual, and the same is true actually militarily across the board, there are certain things that must, by definition, be mechanically done with precision and do not evolve. And that's okay. It's simply not a ritual, because a ritual is something that naturally evolves. We're going to move into the article, because otherwise we'll run out of time, but hold on to thoughts and questions. So he wants to go in the second paragraph to an aspect of a post-October 7th Seder. He wants to focus on one object, a ritual change that's meant to call out attention to more than 130 hostages, men, women, and children still captive in Gaza after more than 6 months. I make this proposal with some trepidation. After all, one of the parts I love about our family Seder is the predictability of the rituals, even down to the same melodies for the songs year after year. And as a rabbi who studies liturgy, I appreciate the constancy of the words and the symbols of the Seder. I would like to say, since we're, it's not that we're short on time, but I know we'll run out of time if I open this up to a wider conversation. I'd just like to say that I'm looking forward to a conversation in which I really challenge Rabbi Confer on this point. I don't think this is true for him if he thinks about it and examines his own Seders and traditions. My guess is that a Seder doesn't feel like the Seder unless you've done certain elements, but even so, every year it's slightly different. People are sitting in different seats. Somebody suggests one of the two, if you really think about it, two traditional melodies that you've used for the order of the Seder or for Adir Hu or for something else along those lines. I bet he gets excited when somebody brings him a copy of a new Haggadah to try out. So even if the words are exactly the same and the Seder is, he's reading it from a different page. So I think there's a challenge to be made there, but it's not the point of the study that we're doing. I just think that there's a challenge to be made about how much he really loves that constancy. Rather, there has to be just enough constancy to anchor everything so that you can do everything else a ritual requires, which is evolution, a new sense of intentionality, something that goes beyond the practical. I love about our family, as a rabbi who studies liturgy, I appreciate the constancy of the words and symbols of the Seder, and yet making no change this year in the rhythm of the Seder seems tone deaf to me. I wondered, is there a change we could make that itself is traditional and yet reflects our current moment? I wonder if there is change itself that is traditional. What is change that is in of itself, in and of itself, traditional? Tybel, what's change that's in and of itself traditional?
This may be more specific than you're looking for, but I was immediately reminded of the fifth child after the Shoah, or the third matzah. I'm sorry, the fourth matzah. The extra matzah and the fifth child that was added after the Shoah, that was added during Russian Jewry. There are specific items that get used to innovate depending on what's being memorialized or noted.
Okay, so you're already going to a place that we are going to get to, which is that there is a tradition somewhat affixed within the Pesach Seder of innovating around certain elements of the Seder itself. Let's go more broadly. You're right that it is a bit specific, but in a good way, Taiwa. Let's go a little bit more broadly. What does it mean for a change in and of itself to be traditional? Right. Right. Rabbi Barenbaum is following a tradition that many, many different voices are saying from around the world, that of course part of the Seder's tradition is to welcome guests. This is very similar and a nice parallel to Sukkot, this idea at Ushbizin, that really our Seder table, much like our Sukkah, is not complete unless we have other people there. And what is a better example of incompleteness than the people who cannot be at a Seder this year? Your examples and Taibos are great examples. I'm going to zoom us out for a minute and say that there are parts of the Seder that seem to be incomplete in and of themselves, like they are incomplete unto themselves, unless we have offered some innovation in there. He doesn't give this example in his text, but I would say that the Haggadah itself tells us in plain language that there is an expectation at the Seder that the Magid, the telling, will not be static. It is a tradition, meaning that it is a fixed thing that has happened from generation to generation, which is different than ritual. Tradition requires passing down. Ritual can be immediately authentic, even if you are the first to do it. Let me say that again. A tradition is passed down from generation to generation, may or may not be ritual, and can be authentic once it's been passed down from one generation to another. Ritual is authentic even before you've passed it on to a next generation. That is critical, and it's critical for understanding what it means for a rabbi or for you personally to say, I'm affixing this ritual at my Seder. And there are parts of our Seder that, per the Haggadah, require us already to be innovative, because it's just not a Magid unless we have expounded upon the story in an interesting way. You can't just read it from the Haggadah. No one wants you to anyway. You don't want to get bored, but it's actually a tradition to expound upon it. And then there are these other elements that Alan and Teibel are mentioning throughout the Haggadah that may or may not be in the Magid section themselves, that for which it has become specifically traditional for us to innovate upon those parts of the Seder. It has become traditional for us to consider what symbols belong on the Seder plate beyond the symbols on the Seder plate. And now I'm going to tell you what I think Rabbi Confer is saying when he says, is there a change we could make that itself is traditional? I think that he is expressing a discomfort here. He is an authority figure. He's an educated authority figure, and he's a remarkable leader. But he knows that even though it's true that a ritual can be authentic from its moment of birth, that orange on the Seder plate was authentic from the moment that Susanna Heschel did it, he still knows that one which is rooted in tradition, a ritual that's rooted in tradition, will carry with it a different weight for people who he would wish to adopt this tradition. Or maybe it's just for himself. He doesn't just want a ritual. He wants a ritual that feels linked to a chain of ritual innovation that took place in years past. Let me say that one other way. A ritual feels better to some people when that ritual seems to be in a chain of tradition, of innovation, of ritual innovation. There is something that works better for some people about this idea that, for example, we're leaving a seat open at the table just as we did for Soviet Jewry, just as we did when we were offering twinned names post-Shoah, just as we did going back and back and back through our history. There's something that works better for some people. That is not the only way to experience ritual authentically, but that's what Rabbi Confer wants to do. He wants to find a history of ritual innovation to which he can link the innovation that he'd like to make. It would be enough, Dayenu, if he said, I just want to do this. Here's what I'd like to do with matzah at the Seder this year. But he's not doing that. He wants to link it to a traditional chain of ritual innovation, as funny as that is, a traditional chain of innovation. So what he says is, with this in mind, I propose a very simple but powerful shift in the food at the Seder. Instead of the three matzot that are included on the Seder table, usually wrapped or covered in cloth, use only two. When it comes time to break one of the matzot to hide half for later, the afikomen is the half that's hidden for later. What do we call that step in the Seder of the breaking? Yachatz, our fourth step in the Seder. We do yachatz, we break the middle, so to speak, of that, those matzot. We break that in half and hide half as the afikomen. It can only be true that we're breaking the middle matzah if there are at least three, right? So what does that mean? Rabbi Confer is going to tell us. At the meal, which begins with eating matzah, instead of abundance, we will feel absence. Using 1.5 matzot at the Seder meal instead of 2.5 is actually an ancient tradition. Now, this is where I pause and I say, Rabbi Dr. Vanessa Oakes, who is an anthropologist and an extraordinary ritualist and ritual studies person, says there are three ways to authenticate a ritual, and none of them are this. So one is that you authenticate a ritual with a ritual object from the tradition that you're trying to evoke something in. Number two is a ritual text, a sacred text from that tradition. Sacred, according to a completely different definition by Vanessa Zoltan, who's a great thinker in the world of theology, sacred means any text that is sacred to you. To her, Vanessa Zoltan, who I love to cite, she says Jane Eyre is a sacred text for her. She studies it in depth the way that other people study religious texts. Why not? There's no limit to that. So you need either a sacred object or an action, a sacred text, or you need a sacred core notion of that tradition. So something along the lines of all who are hungry should come and eat, or every person is made in the image of the divine. Those are core notions, core concepts. Any one of those three alone can authenticate a ritual. Any one of those alone can authenticate a ritual. Some of us have favorites. I love ritual objects. Actually find sacred objects, sacred ritual objects, much more effective for authenticating ritual than sacred text is. As much as I love liturgy and as much as I love our sacred tradition, I happen to really love objects. What Rabbi Confer says is, using 1.5 matzot at the Seder meal instead of 2.5 is actually an ancient tradition. Remember, what is he trying to authenticate here? Not ritual. He's authenticating a tradition. He's trying to say, this is authentic because I can point to the history of other people doing this. This is rooted in that history. Why does he need that? Hold that thought and that question. We're going to circle back around to it. If it could be authentic immediately, why does he need to root it way back there? Let's look at the traditional sources that he cites. It's reported in the Talmud in Brachot 39b, that's the Babylonian Talmud, and indeed it's meant to symbolize the scarcity that we experienced when we were in captivity in ancient Egypt. And he wants to note that for the sake of the source, you understand that their matzah was softer than ours, so it was sort of wrappable, okay? And then he cites these two pieces that are on the next page, Brachot 39b. This resolution is reinforced in a unique case as Amar Rav Papa Hakol Modim BePesach. Everybody agrees that on Pesach Shemaniach Prusa B'Toch Shlema Uvotzea. Mai Tama Lechem Onegtiv. Everybody agrees that on Pesach you put one, you put the piece inside the hole, and you break a half of it. So he's talking about a piece and a half of matzah. What's the reason behind this? The ta'am, the flavor of this, that it represents. Lechem Oni, and in this case you have Steinsaltz explaining that Lechem Oni is represented by the fact that poor people tend to eat crumbs. You don't tend to get the whole pieces, you tend to get the the crumbs and just the pieces. That, by the way, I find a beautiful image. I find that to be a beautiful image, that when somebody is lacking in their life and they're gifted something, they tend to get the dented can handed over to them. They tend to get the crumbs as opposed to the main slice of the thing. So we understand that this is why we have just the matzah and a half. And he wants to establish a matzah and a half is what they were picturing at the time of 600 CE, at least. This was the tradition according to Rav Papa. Backside of the first page, and our back half of the article. Throughout Jewish history, leading authorities such as Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi and the Rambam, Maimonides, and he's going to cite him in the Laws of Chametz and Matzah, they report using only 1.5 pieces of matzah at the meal. Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna says explicitly that according to the Talmud, one needs only 2 matzot, not 3. Tell me, when a rabbinic authority says, you only need 2 matzot, not 3. You only need 1 kikar to make motzi if you don't have the 2. What is, typically speaking, the impetus behind a ruling like that? If you don't have wine, you can make kiddush on bread. This is another true ruling. What's behind all of those halachic rulings? Be as practical as possible. Practical as possible to make your ritual happen. Tybel seems, where is that what you were going to say, Tybel?
I was going to say scarcity.
Scarcity is even more specifically, though I think that's under the umbrella of what Bobby was saying. When you might not have access to the fullness of what is prescribed in the tradition, rabbinic authorities want to make sure that you understand that you can, in those cases of scarcity, have less than. We'll take your comment, Rosa. Great. So I love what you're saying. I doubt that that's the impetus behind what is here. What you're saying is, wouldn't it be great if what we did was only use a piece and a half? Because we don't want to waste what we don't eat and we don't want to go to those lengths. My guess is that in the time of 600 CE or earlier, when these sources are being cited from, that we're actually in a time when people would have been lucky to have access to all of those things. I want to hold the thought. I want to put a pin in the thought you offered, because it is a reframing for people in our contemporary time. So the story that I will give Women Equality, the day that I put an orange on the Seder plate, is a false narrative. It's not a true story, or rather, it's a story that's told. When I say a false narrative, what I mean is it's not the origin of the ritual. The origin of the ritual was that Susanna Heschel placed an orange on the Seder plate out of solidarity, and others developed this narrative and the story around it, which is a wonderful and evocative story. And that story has its own truth to it. I want to move back into this idea of the scarcity in the Kikar wrote these pieces of the matzah, and say that I think it's important for us to understand here, as we watch what Rabbi Confer is going to do with the matzot, that according to the Talmud, one only needs 2 matzot, not 3, which is the precise opposite, a mentality of scarcity. One might not have 3 matzot, and in that case, they are permitted to only use that number of matzot, the 2, and one of them will be broken, as opposed to what he's about to propose, which is the notion that, of course, we have access. We have access to crates of matzah. Right? They come, you literally can't if you want to. I have a hard time finding singular boxes of matzah. You have too much matzah, and now he's going to suggest you should take that and change it because you can. Limit it because you want to. Make a point through the limitation, which is the opposite of this citation here. Matzah is a complex symbol. Elsewhere in the Haggadah, Rabban Gamliel says it represents our redemption, which is a little bit counter to the narrative redemption versus the bread of affliction, suffering, scarcity, right? But Rav Papa, our same authority here, insists that matzah is also, and perhaps chiefly, a symbol of our suffering. We begin the telling portion of the Seder, the Magid section, by lifting up the matzah, and we say, this is our lechem oni, ha lachma anya. That's lechem oni, but in Aramaic. We often assume that matzah represents suffering because of its texture, I never assumed that, but I really like that idea. Of course, it's all, you know, it's crispy. It's not what we want after bread, but okay. Challah is so rich in comparison. But the original design of the Seder didn't focus on matzah's taste or shape for its symbolic power. After all, matzah was used year-round in the temple for certain sacrifices. So rather, it focused on its state of wholeness. A piece of matzah is a piece of matzah. Once you break it, it's a broken piece of matzah. Normally, people celebrate Shabbat and holidays with two full loaves. Most Shabbatot, that's a full loaf of bread, right? Remembering the plenty, the opposite of scarcity that God bestowed in the desert through the manna because a double portion fell on Friday before Shabbat. Indeed, on the same page of that Talmud, and I bring this citation as well on the back side of the second page, we learn of this practice. But on Pesach, Rav Papa reports that everybody agrees that there cannot be two full loaves. He says you need a loaf to be broken. You can't have two full loaves. This is because rather we've come to the meal with only 1.5 matzot. The brokenness and the diminished amount of food is the bread of affliction, the symbol of suffering. It is the limit on that food that creates our understanding. In other words, matzah in and of itself can't even do its job, he says. As I read this source in the Talmud, and it says, matzah is the bread of affliction, but it can't do the job. The symbol we need for the ritual is for it to be broken. It has to be limited and broken, and that's what makes it lechem oni. That's how Rabbi Confer understands it. So why do we use 2.5 matzot today? Many medieval authorities wanted to emphasize that Passover was no different from other festivals, other Yom Tov, which, like Shabbat, required two full loaves, so they added another matzah to the original 1.5. They wanted to make sure that you had, if you were able to, now that we're in a position to do so, but oh, we need two full loaves in order to make, loaf being a piece of matzah in this case, we need two full loaves in order to fulfill our Yom Tov requirements of a meal. Now, one could break a matzah in half, but you could still make the blessing once it was broken in half with two full pieces of matzah that would remain two full pieces of matzah. Across Jewish communities, three matzot with one broken, that became the norm. Even Yemenite communities, which followed Maimonides with 1.5 matzot for hundreds of years, eventually adopted the current custom of 2.5. Of course, this solution softened the surprise meant to accompany the matzah. Now we had more bread than regular festivals, not less. So instead of the surprise being that we are down a half a loaf of bread, this is our lechem oni, this is our bread of affliction and scarcity, we only have 1.5, not two. Now we uncover the matzah and we say, ah, on Pesach, we have 2.5. It changes the haftaah, it changes the surprise factor in that moment. But it also changes the meaning. If you were originally deriving the meaning like Rav Papa did from a sense of the scarcity to begin with. So we see Rabbi Confer is proving to us that the meaning of how many matzot that we have shifts with the number of matzot that we choose to have. It's been prescriptive through time. Once we said we need to have these two kikarot, these two full pieces of matzah, in addition to the half piece, in order to fulfill a Yom Tov requirement, just like any other Yom Tov, the symbolism and the ritual itself had to change. The ta'am, the flavor of the ritual, had to change. But guess what? Remember what I said in the beginning? There's a little certain something, that surprise, that je ne sais quoi factor, oh, there's something different underneath the matzah cover. Two, that it's intentional. Right, all of this requires deep understanding. 3, that it goes beyond the practical, which of course is the case if you're adding bread, because it's beyond the practical, right? You're opposite of scarcity. And 4, it evolves over time. And look how deeply this ritual has evolved over time. Strikingly, the Vilna Gaon, a leading authority of the 18th century, recommended bringing back the practice of 1.5 matzot at the meal. If you have 2.5 months, so he said, then this is not the manner of suffering. So he struggled with this idea that we had gone and changed the ta'am, this flavor of that ritual, and said that can't possibly be suffering. Rabbi Confer says, I'm not recommending a permanent change to the Seder, but this is not a normal year. With more than 130 of our people literally in captivity, the shock of seeing fewer matzot at the table when we are used to seeing plenty is appropriate. In fact, it is a version of the shock the Seder was originally meant to induce. Unlike every other Shabbat and holiday, our bread, like our hearts, will be in pieces. This is the nature of matzah at the Seder, as Rav Papa indicated, a reminder of our people's long suffering in slavery before being redeemed. My prayer, he says, is that next year we can celebrate with a full set of 3 matzot again. But for this year, let's mark the suffering of those still in captivity by reducing our plenty and reclaiming the power of the bread of suffering at our Seder. So what you have here is a story the Rabbi Confer has told of the evolution of the ritual of matzah at the Seder table. Maybe we're supposed to have 2.5 pieces of matzah in that moment. 3 pieces, one of which are broken in half. Maybe we are supposed to have 2 pieces, one of which is broken in half. The choice that you make as to how to deal with your matzah this year, if you want to choose to engage in this process of ritual evolution, first of all, will be authentic. Whether you choose to follow one of these or the other, you are making use of the sacred text of Halach Ma'anya. You are making use of the sacred symbol of the matzah as bread. And you're making use of the core idea that Pesach is a time of experiential learning around suffering. And whatever it is that you do, I want you to know that as cool as this article is in understanding the historicity and the evolution, proving the evolution of how these matzot have come to be, that you could do something entirely different. Like say that you wanted to have 7 matzot, such that every person at the table could break 1 in half. Or do what I do in my family, which is to treat it like a wishbone, where people have to hold on to each side, and each person is striving to have the bigger half, because what do we want at Pesach, but rather to be whole again? And what is the story of Pesach, but to realize that no matter how big a piece you want to take, if you break it with someone else, you are going to wind up with a broken piece. It might be big, it might be small, but it'll be broken. You can do any of these things, and it will immediately be authentic. No rabbinic supervision necessary. The point is to engage, to understand the history for those for whom it is really meaningful to be rooted in the history of it. And most importantly of all, to engage in the tradition of innovating. So I can't wait to hear what happens at your Seder tables this year, not about just matzah, but about everything. And I'm so excited for this year's Seder table to engage in a discussion around what it means to have 2 or 3 kikarot of matzah. I look forward to figuring out what ritual you adapt at your Seder to represent that beautiful meaning. Because that's a beautiful teaching by Rabbi Schulweis about what it means to have the hidden revealed. Tell me if you come up with something really wonderful. I'm challenging you to see if you can come up with a something at the Seder table that becomes a ritual of that revelation of the bread of redemption. I'd love to hear about that. And thank you for sharing that. And that's in which Haggadah, remind me?
On the wings of freedom.
I love Haggadah.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.